From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. We tend to think of literature as part of art, reflecting on history rather than making it. But a new book called The Written World explores in great detail how literature and writing have actually themselves shaped world history. As the technology to put words down on paper and in print have evolved, so has the impact of the written word on our political landscape from writing, printing, mass publication, and digital storytelling. Martin Puchner is the Byron and Anita Wien Professor of Drama and of English and Comparative Literature at Harvard University, and he now joins me to discuss his new book, The Written World, The Power of Stories to Shape People, History, and Civilization. He's also written the best-selling six-volume Norton Anthology of World Literature, among other works. Welcome to the program, Martin.
Thanks for having me, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. So when we think about how information has passed down from generation to generation in human history, the advent of writing down words and history should really represent a very important turning point, right? So tell us about that turning point and how important it was when humans started writing things down as opposed to verbally telling them to one another.
It was a huge moment, Sonali, and it's a little difficult to reconstruct exactly how it happened because all of our knowledge really depends on the written record. So it's hard to even imagine how humans lived before. But there's a story told by Mesopotamian scribes in what today is Iraq about the origin of writing. This is story itself is about 4,000 years old. And they imagined a king trying to subdue a rival king. And the king sends a messenger to the rival king and tries to threaten the rival, taunt him, bribe him, but nothing works. And then the king gets so angry that he goes on this long rant, and the messenger panics because he can't remember it all. And it's at this point in the story that this king takes some clay and puts his words on clay and gives the messenger the clay tablet and sends the messenger to the rival. And the rival king is so impressed by this new technology of writing that he immediately submits. So this is sort of an old story about the origin of writing, and it just shows how powerful this technology was seen from the very beginning.
Was writing simply a way, initially, as far as you know, a way to remember things that were too long to be remembered? I mean, you write in your book about the history in India of how priests would, repeat Hindu chants over and over in order to remember them. So did writing just become a sort of practical way to not forget?
Yes, writing had very practical origins. In fact, in Mesopotamia, where the first writing systems were developed, it was initially used for accounting purposes, really, to write down economic transactions, to keep records by a state for tax collection. It was really a bureaucratic technology, if you will, giving rights to the first states. So very mundane, very practical. And it was only after some time that one of these scribes charged with keeping records used writing for a completely different purpose, and that was to write down a story. And as you just said, there were storytelling happens wherever humans lived. So there were these long oral storytelling traditions. But at this moment, when a scribe used this new accounting technique of writing to write down a story, something really important happens, namely the intersection of storytelling and writing technology. And that's, for me, the big bang of literature. This is really when literature as we know it, namely written stories, takes off.
Right. It's not that literature didn't exist before, but oral traditions are different from the written word, because in the telling of a story, because we are human and because we are flawed, things change. As anybody knows, eyewitness reports are notoriously unreliable in the telling of its stories change. But when you write something down, it is concrete and it's often, it's unchangeable. And of course, you leave a legacy for future generations to find. And so we know so much more about what happened in our world after the advent of writing than before, right?
That is so true. And we have to be, in fact, a little careful not to dismiss oral literature
Okay.
as, insignificant, because you mentioned the case of India, where there were very elaborate oral traditions and divisions of labor, where certain people would remember certain parts of the Vedas, for example, and other people other parts. So they were very rich oral storytelling tradition, and they continued to live side by side with writing. But yes, writing as a technology, once it's used to write down stories, allows people to project written stories to far afield, to different parts of the world, and somehow miraculously to speak to the future, to imagine that they were reading, addressing readers in the distant future, and as readers, imagining that they were communicating by reading old texts with people from the distant past. So it really changed the relationship to time, imagining this dialogue between the past and the future and between very remote parts of the world.
Was there resistance to this new technology? Whenever we have new technology, of course, there is hemming and hawing from
Right.
all sectors about how it will change things. And we have that same conversation today about how the internet is changing reading and writing and communication. So when writing as a technology emerged, were the old school folks who relied on oral traditions resisting it?
That's exactly right. And I wrote this book very much before the background of this experience we all share, namely that we are going through this extraordinary revolution in writing technologies where how we communicate changes profoundly. And so one motivation for the book was to look at these earlier moments, what happens at earlier moments of technological transformation. And so there was resistance. There were people who were worrying about writing. I have a chapter on some of these charismatic teachers like the Buddha, like Confucius or Socrates or Jesus, who lived in literate cultures, who could have written, but who deliberately chose not to and insist instead on live interactive teaching with their students. So of those figures, Socrates was the most explicit about his worries about writing. He worried that you can't ask a text follow-up questions. You can't ask for clarification. It's very easy to take a text out of context and do something else with it. So he worried that there is huge room for misunderstanding and miscommunication. And he also worried that once we trust this external storage device of speech, we would no longer have to know things ourselves. So that was one example of an early worry about writing, and there were many similar worries. So yes, technological change, especially new powerful technologies that change the way we communicate, always go hand in hand with people worrying about those effects.
Right. And so the advent of the written word also enabled stories to be passed across the globe, across these vast geographical expanses that hadn't been imagined yet. That you could actually convey information without having to speak face to face with somebody was a pretty remarkable thing. So not only did the act of writing stories become this great technological wonder, the influence of stories far beyond their initial reach were also a very important impact to world history. You say, and you write in your book about Alexander the Great and the impact that the written word had on him. And of course, his impact on history is huge. So tell us that story.
It is huge. And of course, everyone knows that he was this incredible conqueror who conquered parts of Persia and all the way to northern India. But what really struck me is that the motivation for this conquest of parts of Asia was a text, namely the Iliad by Homer, a text, the Greek epic that he had grown up with and that describes a much earlier excursion of a Greek army into Asia Minor, what's now on the Turkish coast, to Troy. And when Alexander starts his conquest of Asia, he starts at Troy, and he takes his copy of the Iliad with him, and he sleeps on it every night. And he imagines that he is reenacting that older story. So that's, of course, one way in which literature shapes history, by shaping the minds of people who then go out and act and change history.
And of course, not always for the best, but that is how all technologies are, right? There is a good side and a bad side of all technologies, as we are again seeing with the revolution that the internet has brought today. And so going back to the written word as a technology that has a dark side, that you were saying Socrates had these concerns about, that were quite valid concerns. What were the upsides of the written word and that technology? What were the ways in which learning about one another through the literature that cultures produced actually resulted in progress for humanity?
You know, I think it did, Sonali, because it allowed for an accumulation of knowledge. And the place where this happens is in these wonderful ancient libraries, like the Library of Alexandria or the Library of Pergamon in what's today southern Turkey, so that you can pass knowledge down to the next generation and gather knowledge from distant parts of the world. It really supercharges cultural evolution, where humans were able to accumulate knowledge and experience and process that and make that part of what it is to be human. And that's, of course, a very powerful technology that ultimately leads to science and to history and all other, really most other forms of knowledge. Mm. And that's an impressive achievement of the written world that we need to honor, I think.
So storytelling is as old as humanity, but this sort of aspect of literature that we call the novel is something that we take for granted today. And in your book, you trace back to try to find what the first great novel in world history was, the one that had a global impact. I mean, if we think of what might have had a global impact in literature today, we might think of the children's writer J.K. Rowling and her Harry Potter books, perhaps among the most widely read words of modern fiction. But tell us about the first great novel in world history, going back to ancient Japan.
Exactly. So there are a lot of people, especially in the West, think that the novel is a Western achievement and a Western product. But once you look at the deep history and world history, you realize so often that that's not the case. And the origin of the novel is a good example. So the first great novel in world history is really The Tale of Genji, which was written by a lady-in-waiting at the court of Japan around the year 1000 of the Common Era. And she chronicled this very secretive and rarefied life at court with unbelievable precision and psychological insight, which means that we really know more about the Japanese court around the year 1000 than we know about any other place in medieval history, because we have this long, it's a very long novel, it's about 1,000 pages long, but it's really a fascinating story. And the story that's equally fascinating to me is how Murasaki Shikibu, the author, came to write it, because she had to basically acquire her literary knowledge in secret, because women weren't supposed to acquire it. So she overheard or spied on her brother being tutored, and that way acquired literary knowledge, and then put it into practice with this fascinating, psychologically astute first grade novel, The Tale of Genji.
What about converting oral traditions and literature into writing? We've heard, many of us have heard of course, the 1001 Arabian Nights, this very, very sort of famous collection of short stories from the, you know, ancient Arab world that has delighted, you know, people for generations. What was that an example of in the history of writing technology?
We all grew up with the Arabian Nights because they really conquered the world and were retold by Disney and many other in many media. The story about the Arabian Nights is interesting because it shows the emergence of a more popular form of literature, quite different from the early epic texts like the Homeric epics, also very different from early foundational religious texts that I talk about, but much more entertaining, much lighter, also bawdier in some ways. And the driver of that change, the way in which these kinds of stories made it into writing, again had to do with a revolution in writing technologies, in this case paper. Paper was originally invented in China and then made it into the Arabic world. Baghdad became a center for paper making. And the great thing about paper was that it really lowered the cost of literature, and that allowed more readers and writers to be connected to literature and to writing. And that led to an explosion of popular storytelling that was written down. And the Arabian Nights is really a collection of stories. The stories themselves come from all over the place, including India and Greece and the Arabic world itself. But the amazing thing is that these stories that would have been told orally initially were now written down and collected, and we're able to reshape literature.
I want to get to religious texts and their significance, but in a minute, one of the things that strikes me when we talk about the advent of popular literature is that in order to, of course, consume that literature, one needs mass literacy. And with mass literacy comes mass awareness and learning and education. How did the popularization of writing technology and then the consuming of that on a mass scale increase the sort of political awareness that human beings had about other cultures, about their rights, about what they might want or expect from their leaders? I know that's a huge question, but it's such a fascinating one.
It is. And it's a story that proceeds in fits and starts. And education is crucial, as you say. What I was struck by was there are these early texts from scribal schools, again, from like 3,000-4,000 years ago. And they sound so modern because you have students complaining about their strict teachers who beat them, who are mean to them. And you have stories of teachers who complain about students, saying that students used to be much better, but now this younger generation is no good. And so you
realize. So echoing so many conversations we hear today.
Exactly. And you realize that this schooling in literature and reading and writing has been, in some sense, the same for the last 4,000 years. The big difference is, as you mentioned, is that more and more people have been able to participate in it. And that's, I think, partially driven by technologies that lower the cost of literature and that start a kind of virtuous cycle where as the costs become lower, as literature, also literacy, becomes easier. For example, with the invention of the alphabet, that makes it much easier to learn how to read and write. More people gain access to it, and that means that they are now demanding to be heard, that they want a voice in the conversation. So I do see, broadly speaking, a democratization of literature. Initially, for a long time in the ancient world, literature is really a very small and very elite phenomenon. But step by step, it becomes democratized. And then that changes the way people think about literature and who has access to it and whose story gets to be told. And this, I think, goes all the way to our own moment. And there are a lot of people who worry about the effects of the internet and our own writing and reading revolution. And I share some of these worries. But ultimately, I think I'm an optimist here, because I see that today more is being written and read than ever before. And more importantly, more people have access to writing and reading. More people can publish. More people can raise their voice in writing than ever before. And that just has to be a very good thing.
Let's talk about religious texts. There are whole courses taught about the interpretation of ancient religious texts and what they mean for, the mindset or the ideology of large communities of people. There are debates that rage. And so how did the technology of writing change religion, change the way in which religion can sort of capture the allegiance of people? Because now you can put a religious ideology down on paper and pass it around far and wide.
It had a huge effect. And the first thing to be said about it, perhaps, is that today, of course, we live in a world in which, when we think of religion, we almost automatically think of sacred texts. That's not only true of the so-called religions of the book, namely Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, but also of Hinduism, of Buddhism. Really, almost all religions today, almost all world religions, are religions based on sacred texts. But like all things, this idea of a sacred text had to be invented. A little moment ago, we talked about the very mundane sort of accounting origins of writing. And so before that background, you realize that it actually was kind of surprising that this accounting technology would suddenly play such a large role in religion. For me, the origin of that, of the idea of sacred text, is the moment when Ezra returns with a group of exiled Jews from Babylonian exile to Jerusalem to reclaim the city and reinstitute Judaism as a temple practice in that city. But he doesn't just return to rebuild the temple. He brings something with him from Babylonian exile, the center of literacy at the time, and that is these written texts. And what he does upon his return to Jerusalem is he builds a stage, and he takes these scrolls and he holds them up, and he demands that the people pledge allegiance to these scrolls and that they worship them as if they were a god. And that, for me, is sort of the first time that a text was really being worshipped like an idol or a god. And so from that moment on, this idea of sacred scripture, that some writings would be seen as divine, takes hold, and over time really affects most religions we have today.
Do you feel that that the written word then fostered inadvertently religious fundamentalism?
So you said earlier that writing is so powerful. That doesn't mean that all the effects were good, and I totally agree with that. And I do think that a side effect of this idea of sacred texts is what I call textual fundamentalism, namely that some people then think that these sacred or foundational texts, and they can be religious texts, they can also be political texts like the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence, need to be read literally and only in one way. And that, I think, is the moment where the power, the immense power of the written word becomes negative, because that's when a certain group wants to control the interpretation of a text, wants to shut down all other interpretations, and wants to really freeze a text in time.
There's Socrates's valid concern about the written word.
That's right. Coming up. That's right. Yeah. Yes, very much so.
Well, let's fast forward tremendously to some to a text that that some non-religious people might find sacred, and that is the Communist Manifesto. And I love that you refer to that in this book as well. Many people have interpreted Marx and Engels's text, The Communist Manifesto, in many ways. It's a very politicizing book. It's considered controversial. It is, you know, depending upon your ideology, something you find sacred or something you find anathema. How did the Communist Manifesto, what impact did this book have on politics?
One reason why I felt like I wanted to include this text is that I feel like they were, you know, all of the texts I talk about were influential sooner or later, but in many of the examples, it took many centuries for these texts to develop their, like the Bible or other texts, to develop their full impact. The story of the Communist Manifesto is unusual because it had an enormous impact relatively quickly. Not immediately. It takes about 40 years for the Communist Manifesto to really change the minds of people and to inspire this idea of a communist revolution. But once it does, it works almost like wildfire. And that was such an unusual case study of a text that had such an effect so immediately. The other thing that was important for me in that case, as in the other political texts I talk about, namely the Declaration of Independence, is that I wanted to make sure that when we think about literature, we don't just think about the fiction bookshelf, that we include in this idea of literature written stories. Right. And written stories can be religious texts, as we just said, but also political texts. And the Communist Manifesto very much is a story. It tells an enormously captivating story about the history of humankind, and focuses on this one feature, namely class exploitation, and then turns that story into a call for action. So it's very much a storytelling text, and I think part of its influence was that it didn't just, there were many manifestos they were written after it, and at the same time they didn't have much of an impact. I think the reason why the Communist Manifesto did have the impact it did is because Marx and Engels, its authors, understood the power of storytelling.
So finally, here we are at a moment in time where the way in which we tell stories, the way in which we consume literature is changing. I mean, it is and it isn't, right? A novel can still be written in the same way that it was written, but on a computer, and read in the same way it was read, except your page might be digital rather than a physical paper page, but its reach can be greater. We're in an age where self-publishing is something that's much more accessible than before, so there's sort of fewer gatekeepers to publishing. How do you view the technology of writing as having evolved to today? What is the revolution that we're witnessing, technological revolution that we're witnessing, represent in the long scheme of things?
Well, there are many things that are new, but there are also things that are old. I was struck by two things that reminded me of much earlier moments in the history of writing. The first is the tablet. They're wonderful images of early scribes with their clay tablets sitting cross-legged. And I'm struck by the fact that for the first time really in millennia, we are writing on tablets again. And when I look at
literally
some of my students sitting cross-legged on the floor of the library, they look like these ancient scribes. The other thing is that we are scrolling again. People had been using the scroll as their main form of writing until most scrolls were replaced by the Roman invention of the codex, which is the book. And we were mostly writing in books and publishing in book form because the book is very convenient as an object. You can flip through very quickly. It has many other advantages. But today we are scrolling down our screens again because computer encode texts continuously. You can simulate pages, but it's really the scrolling, the continuous text that has returned. So some things are new, some are old. But if I draw one conclusion from this long 4,000 year history of reading and writing, it's that new changes in technology really also change not just how we write, but also what we write. And so you're right. For now, novels continue to be written and they're maybe only distributed more effectively in ebooks. But I would say over the long term, I think we will write differently because that's what happened in all these earlier forms, that new technologies bring in different formats and different genres that somehow are appropriate for these new forms of writing. So I don't quite know what will happen. But, you know, if we look around, we can see that there are many short forms of storytelling that seem to be thriving right now, from Twitter to blogs. There are super specialized forms of romance that thrive that are published on Amazon and find large readerships. So they're emerging right all around us, new forms and genres and types of literature. And I think that will continue to be the case.
Well, since you brought up Twitter, I just can't resist asking you the question of how, when we talk about words as having power, our commander-in-chief has a lot of power in his words and through his Twitter feed. Where do you place Donald Trump's Twitter feed into the grand scheme of historical, you know, sort of writing? He is leaving behind a written legacy that we are going to be able to parse through many years from now.
Right. Well, you know, I a moment ago I talked about this story about the origin of writing, where one angry king invents writing in order to communicate with a rival. And I have to think about that story now when I think of Donald Trump communicating with Kim Jong-un of North Korea via Twitter and trying to impress his rival with these text messages. And I think that the story about the origin of writing in Mesopotamia is a story now about a first text message by one angry king to another. So from some perspective, again, Donald Trump's use of Twitter is maybe not so new. But of course, you're right. It is a new technology that allows a president or sovereign to communicate much more directly with the people. And that's going to change. Right now, we only have, in a way, Trump as our first tweeting president. And, most people are dismayed by it. It will be interesting to see what future presidents and other leaders, how they use this new form of communication. And I think it will have an interesting effect. And I don't know whether Trump's use of this medium right now will prove to be typical or atypical. My sense would be is that different leaders will be able to wield this technology maybe in somewhat different ways.
Well, Martin, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Is there a website you'd like to share about your book?
Yes, I have a website. It's simply my first and last name, martinpuchner.com, MartinPuchner. And I tweet, of course, as Martin_Puchner.
We'll post links to both of those from our website later today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Sonali.
My guest is Martin Puchner. He is the Byron and Anita Wien Professor of Drama and of English and Comparative Literature at Harvard University. He's written the best-selling 6-volume Norton Anthology of World Literature, among other works, and we've been discussing his new book, The Written World, the power of stories to shape people, history, and civilization. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.